Okay. So my abstract was written before I wrote the talk, and it turns out that I can't quite get to the stuff that is in the abstract today. So what we're talking about is this paper called Gauge Theories Labeled by Three Manifolds. Sorry, labeled by three manifolds. I have to say that, right? And, you know, I gave the number before, but here it is, 1108-4389. And the basic idea is that we take a three-manifold. It's actually going to be a three-manifold with boundary. And we write this three-manifold with boundary in some appropriate way as a union of certain ideal tetrahedra. And of course, those have boundaries as well.
We just added a boundary.
Yeah, yeah. So somehow we got doubling, a doubling phenomenon. So so this is the third of several talks about this paper, but people who didn't come to the earlier ones have a good chance of understanding what's going on, at least as good a chance of understanding what's going on as I do, which is not 100%. So the idea is that we somehow decompose a hyperbolic three-manifold with boundary into ideal tetrahedra, and by analogy with what Giotto and many other people have done in the case of associating four-dimensional field theories to surfaces, we're going to try to associate a three-dimensional field theory to this situation by associating some kind of field theory to the building block, the ideal tetrahedron, and then glue them together to give some more elaborate field theory associated to the three-manifold. So the idea is that Ti, with its boundary, should somehow be associated to some field theory. And then there has to be some kind of gluing procedure. And so the gluing procedure has to work both on the geometric side and the field theory side. And then kind of the check to see that we're doing things in a sensible way is that a given hyperbolic three-manifold may have more than one decomposition into ideal tetrahedra. And so we've got to check what happens if you change the decomposition and check that we get the same field theory or isomorphic field theories, in some sense, if we've changed that decomposition. So what I realized as I was preparing the talk is that there is an additional ingredient to this which we haven't discussed, which I need to try to discuss first. So in this naive form, the idea is not carried out quite exactly in this naive form. In fact, there's some additional data which is associated to the boundary. So the additional data on the boundary is the data of a flat SL2C connection. On the boundary of the three-manifold, mod gauge equivalents. And so, in the course of doing this building up of the entire three-manifold out of the pieces, we're actually going to be specifying the flat SL2C connections on the boundaries of the ideal tetrahedra, and then somehow gluing that data together as well. So what has to roughly be happening is that somehow the data for the flat SL2C connection on the boundary, two things have to happen. First of all, we have to have a way of assembling the flat SL2C connections on the parts of the original boundary which remain on the exterior when you glue things together into an SL2C connection that makes sense on the exterior. And then we also have to have some matching condition for the part of the SL2C connection which is somehow swallowed up in the middle. So the these flat SL2C connections are actually described by means, well, let's see. So the flat SL2C connections, Mott gauge equivalents, are actually going to be contained in a larger set. And this larger set is going to be some kind of complexification of this space. Or, if you like, it's really a it's really more like a quantization of the space, in which the space that describes the flat SL2C connections is sort of doubled in size. It's nice that the audience doubled just before the talk started. Gives me an illustration. And then there's some symplectic structure which explains how the given structure can be thought of as having sort of position and momentum type coordinates in the usual kind of scheme. So the formal way of saying this is to say that there's going to be a phase space on the boundary which is associated to this problem of flat SL2C connections, and associated phase spaces on these various tetrahedra. So this is a phase space on the ideal tetrahedra, which is related to this problem of specifying flat SL2C connections. So I want to
Pardon? Would you mind just giving an example that you have to bear in mind as you go forward?
I would love to be able to do that.
Well, tell me about the topological type of the boundary of F.
Okay, so so the boundary of M should have two sort of parts to it. There should be some part that corresponds to cusps, and there should be some part that corresponds to places where you failed to glue everything together, right? So I guess when I talked a few weeks ago, I had some formal way of saying that, which I've forgotten, but the geodesic boundary components.
When they're cusps, are they meant to be counted as part of this stuff to do with whatever's going on the boundary?
Yeah, I think we have to put this flat SL2Z connection on the cusp parts of the boundary, yes.
So, but so the cusp's at infinity, so how do you do that? Or what does it mean?
So I guess I imagine truncating my ideal tetrahedra just shy of infinity and thinking about...
And then you truncate the tetrahedra as well. So they're not ideal tetrahedra in fact.
Well, if I want to see that structure, I guess I'd probably have to do that, right? But then maybe I take some kind of limit where I let the truncation go off to infinity. Isn't that the way one usually thinks about the cusps?
Well, no, one usually leaves them just to the infinity.
Okay.
So I see. So if it were just a manifold with a single cusp, you'd want me to truncate the cusp and then not work with ideal tetrahedra, and then later on you're going to do something which lets stuff drift off to infinity. Is that correct? So there's some sort of picture I might have.
You're asking wonderfully precise questions which aren't addressed by these authors, and since I don't understand their construction fully, I want to duck them. But let's agree that this is an issue that has to be worried about, because they definitely want to consider this structure both for cusp type boundaries and for geodesic boundaries. And so in order to make sense of it near the cusp type boundaries, we're going to have to do something like what
well, even in the geodesic case, you're going
to
truncate the tetrahedron.
I'm thinking of those somehow. Am I wrong? I'm thinking of those as being the kind of open faces that didn't get glued to other things. Pardon?
Yeah, that's what I do in that paper. It's the ideal tetrahedra together, and there are geodesic faces which are just the geodesic boundary components come from unglued faces.
Yeah.
Right. Is there a different way that one should try to do that?
There are other ways I could do it.
Okay. So there's a funny there's a funny translation of that SL2C structure, which I don't understand the details of quite yet. And that's partly because I didn't think I was going to be talking about that part today until I realized that I had to. So I do apologize for this. So let me give a kind of... So there's a brief summary of what Daryl told us 2 weeks ago about these ideal tetrahedra, which is that... So the ideal tetrahedra have their boundary points at infinity in hyperbolic space, and infinity looks like a copy of CP1, or the tooth sphere. And as such, there's a complex number z, which is essentially the cross ratio of the four points, which labels what's going on. Now, typically, following a construction which goes back at least to Thurston, maybe older, one keeps track of the information by means of labels associated to given edges, and opposite edges get the same complex number data. So this is kind of a way of teasing out the fact that, well, I could label my vertices as 0, infinity, 1, and z, something like that, so that edge would be labeled by z, and then of course I could permute these things and get other labelings involving numbers like 1 over z and 1 over 1 minus z, which in this description are going to be called z prime and z double prime. So z double prime, I have to decide which one's behind which one, but I would have the corresponding labels on disjoint edges there. So these numbers, z, z prime, and z double prime, satisfy two relations which reflect the fact that they're essentially all generated by the same complex number, and we're just using the permutation of the four points on the cross ratio to generate them. One of those relations is that the product of the three numbers is -1, and the other relation is complicated, but it looks something like z plus z inverse plus z prime plus 1 equals 0 or something like that. Let me put a question mark on that one. What we're going to do for the description of this phase space is we're going to drop this equation, and we're going to keep this equation for a minute, and we're going to introduce a symplectic structure on the solutions of that larger equation. So here I'm introducing complex numbers associated to the edges, satisfying one but not both of the equations that we're supposed to be satisfying. So the sort of explicit description of this space is going to be the set of z, z prime, z double prime, living inside of, now I'm not allowed for, these numbers are not allowed to be 0, 1, or infinity. So they were supposed to be c minus 0 and 1, right? That's sort of the rule about specifying the cross ratio. So here I'm taking c star minus 1 cubed, and then the condition is z, z prime, z double prime is equal to minus 1. And that's isomorphic to c star minus 1 squared, as it turns out. Not hard to check. And it's going to be given a symplectic structure by omega equals 1 over h bar dz dz prime. Well, I can solve for any one of the coordinates in terms of the other ones. And within that space, there's a Lagrangian submanifold, which is the actual space that describes the possible structures. So LDT is going to be the set where z plus z prime inverse is equal to 1. And the actual hyperbolic structures are given by this. This is a Lagrangian subvariety for the symplectic space, for the symplectic form. So the part that I didn't really manage to extract too well from the literature yet, it's supposedly implicit in a paper of Neumann and Zagier, but I had a very hard time extracting anything remotely looking like this from Neumann and Zagier. Have you seen it before? Probably not. Is that this space is supposed to be isomorphic to that space of flat SL2C connections. And these are, this space should be the flat SL2C connections on the tetrahedron with unipotent holonomies on the punctures, on the boundary, right? Unipotent holonomies around the punctures, and these should have trivial holonomies on the punctures. So, at the moment, that piece of the geometry I'm having to take as a black box, but I promise that someone, maybe me, will come back to this point and explain how this works. Anyway, we have some boundary structure, and this is a convenient way of describing the boundary structure. The boundary structure consists of labeling edges satisfying a certain condition, and it definitely has a symplectic structure. So, on the field theory side, there's going to be a separation into certain background fields and dynamical fields. And the background fields are going to have possible couplings and expectation values. And those couplings and expectation values are going to fill out this boundary space. So these coordinates end up matching nicely with certain features of the field theories that I'll describe. This extra structure that I'm putting on the boundary also matches with certain good properties of the field theory. So, you know, a mathematician who knows three manifolds, which there are several of in the room that don't include me, would probably ask why bother to put this extra structure when they understand perfectly well how to assemble larger three manifolds out of these basic pieces. And the answer is that they have natural counterparts in this field theory that we're making a correspondence with. So the correspondence is really both an enhancement of the story of the three manifold together with a correspondence between that enhanced structure and a certain collection of three-dimensional quantum field theories. So the additional ingredient that I need to specify the field theory is I need a polarization on this symplectic space PDT, or more generally on the boundary, and that polarization means a choice of conjugate coordinates on the space. And there's a natural class of polarizations in the case of this torus. So the polarizations for the torus, tetrahedron. Polarizations for the tetrahedron, for the boundary of the tetrahedron. The easy ones to start out with are, well, the canonically conjugate variables z and z prime are obvious from the way I've written out the symplectic structure. But if you use this relation, you discover, so this is supposed to be like the position and the momentum. for the structure. If you use this relation, you discover that Z prime, Z double prime, and Z double prime Z are also perfectly good choices for a polarization. We can make other choices of polarization by acting by SP to Z transformations. These give other choices. And in fact, there's a natural, so SP2Z is the same as SL2Z in this, that tells you my convention about symplectic groups. This collection of polarizations gives me some kind of natural set of SP2Z structures. An additional SP2Z enhancement of the structure that's just provided by assigning this symplectic vector space to the boundary. So the beginnings of the dictionary with the field theory are some nice collection of field theories which have, so it's field theories coupled to background fields, and the field theory coupled to background fields is going to correspond to an ideal tetrahedron with a choice of polarization. And then, at least in principle, varying Z, varying the modulus of the ideal tetrahedron, is going to correspond to varying something like couplings in these background fields. So somebody pointed out during the first lecture that I gave that the analogy with the work of Gaiotto and others using decompositions of two manifolds to produce interesting field theories was extremely bad, because in the case of the two manifold, you had continuous moduli for the hyperbolic structure, and in particular, you could take a weak coupling limit, which corresponded to making those tubes connecting the pieces smaller and smaller. And in that weak coupling limit, you could imagine arguing that the field theory made more sense in such a weak coupling limit. Here, it should be emphasized that even though we're treating these various parameters as if they're tunable, by the time you've assembled a large hyperbolic structure, there are serious constraints to gluing the pieces together. And when you assemble them into something, you know, reasonably compact looking, there's no freedom left whatsoever.
But so, you can get it from projecting a hyperbolic plane using discrete. Projections, and can you take a
hyperbolic three manifold?
Right. So right. Can you take a family of those and build and it gets discretely, or is it not even possible?
Right.
I mean, it's discrete.
It's discrete. So there are these funny limiting processes in hyperbolic manifolds in which you do, one of you guys help me, you do some kind of Dane twist type surgery near a cusp, right? And you change the volume, and you can get a sequence of volumes which has an accumulation point by doing something like this. Now, because you're getting a sequence of volumes approaching an accumulation point, it's tempting to think that you've uniformly modified the hyperbolic structure, but I don't think that's necessarily true. It must be true sort of toward the limit that most of the new hyperbolic manifold is close to the next one or something like that, in this Gromov sense of measuring distance between metric spaces by sampling what happens at some collection of points. But, if you want to think of that as a discretized version of going to weak coupling, I'd be a little nervous about doing that.
Okay, but in the field theory, if you take the K of Richard Simon's theory larger and larger, you expect to go to weak coupling.
That's right. No, that's right. So maybe that's the sort of thing that's going on. Yeah, that could be.
So this polarization, is that an element of SL2Z for each tetrahedron?
So the polarization is, if you like, let's see. I forgot to write this out. I could look it up in the paper. I can make SL2Z act. What do I want to do? So Z double prime is 1 over Z prime, right? So if I look at the action on logarithms or something like that, then I could take log Z prime to the new ones by acting by maybe 0, 1, and minus 1, minus 1, something like that.
Choice of preferred bases.
That's correct. And so my bases are going to be related to each other by some kind of SL2Z transformation. I guess my strategy with this room, since I've got, you know, half math and half physics in the room, is to give each of you a tantalizing hint and satisfy nobody. So I'll say a little bit about field theory for a few minutes. So the origin of structure like this in field theory goes back to a paper of Witten from approximately 2002, I think, in which he noticed an SL2Z action on a class of three-dimensional field theories. And to say that it's an SL2 action on the class of 3D field theories is a little funny. You have to say field theories coupled to a background field. And the action goes like this. So I'm going to take a U1 theory with some dynamical fields and some background fields and define two transformations. One of them is named T. And in the transformation T, so I have a background field A. In the transformation T, I just add a Chern-Simons coupling at level 1 to my field theory. In the transformation S, I make A dynamical. So in other words, I have to do something with some kind of kinetic term for A in the Lagrangian, and then I add a new background field and I give it the coupling, so the L goes to L plus 1 over 2 pi A nu with dA. And so, you know, these are two funny kind of operations that you might think to do on a three-dimensional field theory coupled to a background field. The rationale for doing it, one possible rationale for doing it, is to look at the electric magnetic duality in four-dimensional theories. So, for example, you could do it for maximally symmetric gauge theory, and you can ask what effect does this have on 3D boundary conditions. So I actually discussed in the first lecture this picture of relating four-dimensional physics and three-dimensional physics by considering appropriate kinds of boundary conditions. So I could put some 2 plus 1 dimensional object inside my 3 plus 1 dimensional space and imagine a physical theory which was confined to live on that and then which was somehow coupled through some physical interaction to a theory that was living in the 4 dimensional space, 3 plus 1 dimensional space. There was a picture when we reduced from M theory to sort of get some of these ideas going that the boundary theory could be related to a 3 manifold and the bulk theory could be related to a boundary 2 manifold. So there's the sort of reversal of roles between boundary and bulk for the interior part and the effective theory. Here you could imagine trying to apply the electric magnetic duality, which we know exists in these four-dimensional theories, to the class of possible boundary conditions and ask how the boundary conditions are affected by them. And this is what you come up with, this kind of set of rules for transformations for U1 theories.
And are these supposed to take conformal to conformal theories?
These are conformal to conformal. They're supposed to take conformal to conformal, and Witten worked out that S squared is exactly charge conjugation on the background field, which has order 2. So S to the 4th has to be the identity. And that ST quantity cubed is the identity. So voila, we get SL2Z. Now, this was a big mystery, I have to say. You know.
We get a quotient of SL2Z.
Pardon?
We get a quotient.
S to the four, this is S to the 4th equals identity. S squared is this charge conjugation.
So that's, you give me two elements, they satisfy a particular relation of SL2Z, but maybe there's another relation of length of B.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I completely agree. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I have a representation of SL2Z on this space. Right. It's an SL2Z action. So here's the idea of this paper. The idea of this paper is to exploit this SL2Z action and compare it with the SL2Z polarization on boundary conditions for an ideal tetrahedron. So it's not quite the one that Witten was using. So the idea of the paper is, step one, write a supersymmetric version of the SL2Z action and then step two, associate some appropriate supersymmetric three-dimensional conformal field theory to the polarized, polarized, that's the word, polarized pair of the ideal tetrahedron and this phase space for the boundary, and check that if you make a change of polarization according to acting on the preferred coordinates by an SL2Z transformation, that you've exactly modified the field theory coupled to a background in this way. So this is a CFT coupled to a background. Then we have to glue them. Well, I haven't told you which one to associate, but actually the possibility is left open in the introduction of the paper that there might be more than one way of doing this. In other words, there might be interesting collections of field theories associated to three manifolds, of which this where you need to have one of them, some beginnings, some starting point associated to an ideal tetrahedron, and then that would generate field theories associated to lots of other three manifolds by this basic construction. These guys have a particular case in mind that they would like to associate to the ideal tetrahedron, and that would then generate lots of other theories. I'll just say what it is. So it's the theory of a single hypermultiplet. So this is n equal 2 supersymmetric in 3D. It's a single hypermultiplet charged under U1 plus a Chern-Simons term of level minus 1/2. As usual, Guyotis manages to make constructions with things that only barely exist, and then when he puts them together, they exist just fine. So these fractional level Chern-Simons terms bother me a little bit, but the whole thing apparently hangs together okay. So we'll have a single U1 associated to each tetrahedron, then there's going to be a prescription. Well, we haven't learned yet in the lectures about three manifolds in so much detail about how to do the gluing. We learned something about the gluing. There's this condition that has to be satisfied at each edge. So you have to match up the data which is occurring at the edges in an appropriate way, and it was exactly the z parameters which had to be matched up at the edges. So there's going to be a field theory construction, namely taking a product of these theories and then adding an appropriate superpotential to the resulting gadget, which is supposed to carry out that gluing. So we'll glue to some kind of U1 to the N theory, and then add a new superpotential. W, written as a sum of fields, of sum of operators, where the I's are internal edges in the three manifold. And putting in that superpotential has the effect of killing off some of the U1s and rigidifying certain other parts of the structure. And that's actually completely compatible with what had to happen in the geometry. Namely, you were forced to take certain compatible values of these z parameters as you glued together various ideal tetrahedra. So there was this continuous parameter for the hyperbolic structure on the ideal tetrahedron to begin with, but then there are these serious conditions associated to each of the edges. Those conditions in the field theory are somehow encoded in properties of these operators and allow you to get a field theory associated to the glued object.
And where are the background fields living?
So the background fields are always sort of associated to the boundary somehow, and the parameters for the background fields were supposed to be the coordinates in this phase space. So what happens to the phase space when you do the gluing is you end up with certain coordinates which were parameterizing data that was supposed to be on the interior edges, but that data goes away. So you have some symplectic reduction corresponding to, you can build a new phase space, a symplectic reduction corresponding to the U1s that are being fixed, well, in physical language, fixed by that superpotential, and you'll get a smaller phase space, and the remaining coordinates are interpreted as defining an appropriate SL2Z flat SL2C structure on the remaining boundary, on what's now on the outside. So you have a whole bunch of parameters labeling edges, but the interior edge ones go away as parameters, and you end up with a smaller phase space, which is supposed to be telling you about that flat SL2C structure on the boundary.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so I'll answer that the same way I answered Darren, I really wish I could. So the example that everybody works out in detail, the examples that people try to work out in detail are, first of all, a gluing where you just stick together two tetrahedra, right, and try to understand what happens when you glue things together. And then people tend to write down, you know, ideal triangulation of the complement of the figure eight knot, which is sort of example one in hyperbolic three manifolds. So you take a figure eight knot, you take its complement that's a hyperbolic manifold, and now we make an ideal triangulation of it. That particular example is problematic for this theory because the construction of these operators has a technical assumption on the triangulation which is not satisfied by that example. So there aren't simple examples that I can give you at the moment.
Wait, how would you ask for the simplest field theory, and then maybe it's a complicated hyperbolic?
Right. So the other slightly, you know, disquieting thing about this construction is that I'm working with these conformal field theories, which I'm building up through this strange procedure of taking hypermultiples charged by U1s and putting in new superpotentials, and I don't really know what happens when I do that. I don't have.
Are there bifundamentals in this or not?
There are some bifundamentals, and my description so far has hidden the role of the by fundamentals. We have to worry about the bifundamentals. So these guys believe that there will be interesting non-abelian conformal field theories, which has some abelian phase that lets you describe them in this way, but they don't have any examples of that either.
On the left-hand board, you have the letter L.
Yes. yes.
You have the letter L when you compare three manifolds. This
is the It's a different L. It's a different L.
They're both Lagrangian. It's
terrible. Yeah, L stands for Lagrangian, but it means something completely different. Yes.
Hey, but in the innocent single tetrahedron, there wasn't extra matter. This was all. There was, or is there even extra matter here?
It's the single hypermodal, but it's coupled to some background guy. Uh-huh. And now, if under some of these transformations it becomes dynamical, that guy in the background might actually be, you know, after you. Yeah, after you apply some S's and T's, it might become dynamical, and it might also get charged. If you're gluing things together, it might also get charged under something else, right? Under other U1s.
That's how you then are able to write a super.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So this morning, Chris gave a talk about 3D CFTs.
Yeah.
Is there any relation? Are those examples that we understand through some quiver construction a subset of these, or are they totally separate?
Right. So. So one thing one can do with these quiver constructions is one can look at it for U1s, not UNs, right? And if you look at it for U1s, not UNs, the field theory is a little sick, right? I mean, don't ABJM even comment on this, that they can't quite do their thing for U1s, that for a single brain, you need two brains to be able to talk about the field theory. I've forgotten what the problem is with the field theory.
Is matrix model you could actually do for n equals.
Okay, that'd be good.
I mean, are these quiver theories? Is that the first question?
I don't know. They're not obviously quiver theories. Yes.
Should I think about this single tetrahedron theory? As living on the boundary of the four-dimensional theory, this is a way to make the transimons level 1/2 theory consistent. As is familiar from topological design.
Aha. Sure. I'm sort of treating it as the toy model that you use as the building block, right? But all of these things, when there is an honest boundary, they're really supposed to be coupled to some boundary theory. So these background fields that I'm talking about coupling them to may actually have some existence of their own in a bulk theory, right? That's and so that makes minus 1/2 okay? Only 1/2 or other fractions as well?
Half
integers. Okay, good. So it's not quite as bizarre as I thought. Okay, 10 minutes. Yeah, I'm not sure what else I can do in 10 minutes.
Would you like another question?
Yes, I will answer questions for 10 minutes. How about that? Yeah.
So I'm still trying to get interested.
Yes.
Okay, you have a flat SL to C connection on, say, the boundary torus at the end of the day. Is any chance that might be the holonomy that you have for the complete representation?
So there's a paragraph in this paper which you will understand much better than I, which talks about the character variety of C being contained in the character variety of M, C being the boundary, or a boundary component, being contained in the character variety of M. So, right, that some of the connections extend to the boundary, other ones don't. Or did I say it backwards? I said it backwards. I'm very sorry. Right. Right. Obviously, if I had a flat SL2C structure on the whole thing, then I would get one on the boundary. Right. That's how it goes.
That's the polynomial of the boundary torus of the complete structure.
Right. So then, how am I supposed to talk about the cusp? Cusps from this point of view. Is that clear to you?
No.
Okay,
let's ask another question. In the case we had a totally geodesic boundary, then
yes.
You expect that the representation ended up actually being in SL2R.
Why?
Well, in the boundary constraint to be totally geodesic. I mean, it's conjugate into SL2R.
I see. So this may be the difference between the phase space and the Lagrangian subvariety. It may be the sort of endpoint version of that distinction I was making between the Lagrangian subvariety that was sort of a real structure, or if you like, a half-dimensional structure inside this guy, right? I'm kind of guessing. The other sort of buzzword here is that this phase-space construction is supposed to be somehow related to Fock-Goncharov coordinates on the Teichmuller space of the boundary, but since I don't fully understand what those are, I wasn't going to try to get into that this week. But since you may know what those are, I don't know if you know what those are. Well, Daryl's nodding familiarly.
Yeah, I mean, the coordinates on the projecting structure.
Okay. Yeah. So I've run out of steam early, but I will answer other questions. Chris?
Is the sort of punchline here that there's this classification of 3D manifolds in terms of field theories, or?
The punchline is supposed to be some interesting collection of field theories which are labeled by three manifolds. And the hope is that these are the field theories that you would get by reducing the 2,0 six-dimensional exotic theory on a three-manifold to get a 3D theory. Just like these Giotto constructions are supposed to be the reduction on Riemann surfaces with funny puncture conditions to get a 4D theory. And then you could imagine that for a three-manifold with boundary, you were getting, you know, the sort of boundary bulk relationship between these 3 and 4D theories. So if I had a three-manifold with boundary, I would expect to see some background fields necessarily involved in the picture that would explain how it coupled to a bulk 4D theory that was associated to those boundary Riemann surfaces. So that's kind of the aim. Now, you know, having said that, there's a long distance to go before any kind of check can be made of that statement. Like, you know, is there, other than sort of really trivial ones, is there some indication that the reduction to 3D of that 6D theory really corresponds to this particular manifold, right? I don't really. What I have now is some prescription for building up a nice self-consistent family of theories out of three manifolds without really knowing that I'm going to get them from this kind of reduction from higher dimension. You know, one of the things which makes the 4D version of this story convincing is this old stuff of Maldacena Nunez, which constructs explicit solutions that explain how to reduce a five brain on a Riemann surface of arbitrary genus. And we don't have a Maldacena Nunez type solution here to guide us in our study of these guys.
Do you just consider hyperbolic three manifolds or all
These guys have only considered hyperbolic free manifolds. You know, in some measure of things, hyperbolic free manifolds are the most common kind, and so that's a reasonable class to look at. I don't know how, you know, I don't know what version of the story would work for other geometric structures, or even for cases where you had a three manifold where you sewed together two geometric structures to get the three manifold. Yes.
And what's the state of understanding the equivalences on the two sides?
That's right. So when I finished going through the dictionary, and when Daryl finishes telling us about these Pachner, is that the word?
Pachner moves.
So the Pachner moves are how to compare two different triangulations into ideal tetrahedra. And on the field theory side, you can sort of look at that and see if you get some equivalence. And the theories in question turn out to be 3D mirror symmetric. So there really is some nice equivalence of field theories that goes along with the Pachner move. So it makes a very nice set of field theories, even though they're field theories which are kind of hard to describe. I mean, they don't have a nice, you know, the other guy to a construction has this nice quiver thing, and you think you understand the theories just by chopping the quiver into pieces and understanding the pieces. Here we don't really have a good a priori way of saying what the class of theories is that we're looking at, other than it's the theories that we build up out of these pieces using that construction. Conversely, we don't have a very good way of, correct me if I'm wrong, of sort of enumerating all three manifolds, right? I mean, can we enumerate all three manifolds in some systematic way?
Yeah.
And what sort of systematic way is it?
Turing machine can spit them out one by one with no repetition.
Okay. And would this be a Turing machine programmed in a way that I could read the program? What I'm asking is there some is there some systematic and humanly consumable way of...
Well, it'd be like a list of the prime numbers. You look at a trillion-digit prime number, and then you look at the next one.
Right, and they're not so related to each other, right? Yes. So three manifolds are kind of like that. It's not like surfaces where you've got this one discrete parameter of the genus, you've got these nice continuous parameters. After that, three manifolds are, it's a rich and wonderful subject, which I will say for the benefit of my colleagues. But I believe it actually. yeah. Yes?
This matrix model I talked about earlier today, I guess you could compute it with these kinds of theories, right? And that would give you some invariant for the three manifold. Is that an exciting quantity from a mathematical point of view, or is it?
I think these guys know some three manifold invariants, but I think offering them a new one might be interesting. It might turn out, they might shortly tell you that, oh yes, we know this one, right? But new ones.
So can you do the non-abelian version and look for that M C
to So, right. Right. Problem number one is I don't know how to extend even the SL2Z to the non-abelian case. That's SL2Z, right? So that's actually the one of the issues. You have to ask the question, if this is really coming from the five-brain theory, which five-brain theory was it? And since it's all U1s, I might guess it's one five-brain, and then I might guess that I had to do some UN version of it for N five-brains or something like that. But because we don't really know how to put the pieces together for the multiple guys at the moment, I'm not sure. Okay, well, thank you for your patience. Sorry it sort of fell apart.